Big color, bigger savings. It's Sherwin-Williams' biggest super sale. Get 40% off paints and stains October 17th through the 27th with prices starting at $29.39. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Holly K. Dunn is an author, speaker, nonprofit founder, and the sole survivor of a serial killer. As Holly began her junior year of college, she and her boyfriend, Chris, were attacked not far from Chris's fraternity party on August 28, 1997, by a murderer who was dubbed the Railroad Killer. In the nearly three decades that have followed, Holly has faced her grief journey, the criminal justice system, and an impactful career in the media with immense grace. Holly also went on to co-found her own nonprofit called Holly's House, release her book entitled Soul Survivor, and she continues to advocate deeply for survivors across her state and the nation. The Broken Cycle Media team is immensely grateful for Holly's undying dedication to advocacy and carrying on Chris's memory.
My name is Holly K. Dunn. I'm from Evansville, Indiana. It's at the very southern tip of Indiana. I grew up in the most amazing family. I had the most amazing childhood. I truly would not change a thing about the way I was raised. My siblings that I had and my parents that I have, it was so fantastic. I think if people could describe me even today, especially when I was younger, the number one thing that my grandma used to say about me was that I was feisty. I learned early on that humor was something that I could use to diffuse situations and to help people if they needed that. Humor to me can cure a lot of uncomfortableness, it can cure sadness, embarrassment. People would say I was outgoing, driven, almost an overachiever. I didn't get the best grades in school, but I overachieved at sports and anything to do with competitiveness. I just really had a drive in me. I would guess that it came from my dad. My dad is one of the most resilient, driven, loving people that I know. And I think that I got a lot of my personality from him. In my life, there was never the question of, are you going to college or not? The question that was always asked to me when I was a child was, where are you going to college? But I really wanted to go to college. I applied to many colleges, but three of them had accepted me. I had visited them and actually had a place to live, classes in place, and had paid a deposit at three different universities because I could not decide where I wanted to go. Finally, with 2 weeks before school started, I chose that I was going to go to the University of Kentucky. I loved Lexington. It was the most beautiful campus and the most beautiful city. I was so excited to go to college. I joined Kappa Kappa Gamma, and the rest was history. Joining a Greek organization is really what kept me in school. It helped me not only have instant friends, but leadership opportunities. It was the summer of 1997, my junior year. I would usually go home for the summer. This was the first time I'm going to stay in Lexington and take summer school. The campus grew so much smaller because there just weren't a whole lot of people that stayed for the summer. I met Chris on the night that my roommate turned 21. She really wanted to go get her first legal drink. Our house that we were staying in was off Maxwell. And on Maxwell was a laundromat that was attached to a bar. So we went into the bar. It was pretty empty, but there was a few guys that were all together. So we went up to the bar and bought Annie her drink. Then, according to her, I went up and started talking to the guys. I noticed this really tall guy. He's like 6'5 and super cute. I don't go over and talk to him because he's talking to some of the other girls that were with us. So I go belly up to the bar with a couple of the other guys. We order a drink and we're sitting at the bar. This tall guy comes over to me and he sits down next to me at the bar. His toes were in some Birkenstock shoes, so you could see them. And his toenails were painted silver. And he said to me, "Look, our toes are the same," because my toes were also painted silver and I had on sandals. He made that first introduction. And of course, we talked more that night. We had actually never met before, which was interesting because the fraternity and the sorority had done things together. He was a Phi Kappa Psi. We invited all the guys, which was probably six of them, to our apartment the next night because we were having a party for her birthday, my roommate. And they said they would come. I actually was downhearted that night because on the way home, everybody was saying, "Hey, did you see that really cute tall guy?" Everybody noticed him. And so I was like, oh man. The next night comes. And when Chris arrives at the party, he comes and talks to me. We talked the entire night. We went and took a walk right down from our apartment. There was a park with a playground. We sat on the swings and we talked. It was just a perfect beginning. It was interesting though, because we're almost taken aback by how great this was going. We even had to take a step back and be like, let's just be friends for a while and see where this goes. So I got to keep getting to know Chris, what kind of music he liked and what he liked to do. He was an artist. He loved to draw. He loved to do things with his hands. He had two girl roommates, which I found out that's why his toes were painted silver. His roommates had painted his toes silver, and he had just never bothered to take it off. He loved everything to do with the outdoors. He was the kind of guy who never had a bad day. That's what I think I was the most attracted to, was that he met every day like it was his last. Chris had had this plan to go to a concert in Maine toward the end of the summer. Right before he left, I remember him saying to me, "Holly, I'm glad we've become friends, but I really want to be more than friends." And I was like, music to my ears, that's what I want to. We had maybe a day or two, and then he's leaving to go to Maine to a Phish concert. He was going to be gone for a week. He called me a few times while he was there. This is a time when he was calling me from a payphone, and I missed his phone call every time he called me, but I had these voicemails. I wish I still had them because they were the most funny thing you ever heard. I had actually moved back into the Kappa house. We were getting ready to go through recruitment. I'm thinking about Chris and so excited for him to get home. He gets home and we're in the middle of recruitment. We made a plan that we were going to get together on Thursday night after my recruitment and after his, we were going to go to this fraternity party, and it was off campus. It was at a house that Chris had lived in before, so he knew the area. And he's like, I'm going to come pick you up at 8 o'clock. I remember getting ready for the night. I was so excited. It was August, so it was still really hot in Lexington, probably 90 degrees or more. But I wanted to look cool, so I wore my khaki corduroy pants, a leather brown belt, and I had a white V-neck t-shirt just tucked into my pants. And then I wore my Birkenstock clogs that were my very favorite shoes. I'm waiting on the side porch. Chris pulls into the Kappa driveway. He had a megaphone on his car where he could talk and it would be outside the car. He gets on the megaphone and he says, Holly Dunn, come out to the car. Let's go to the party. We go to the party. I didn't know a lot of people. I maybe only knew two or three people at this party. So I think he started to feel like we really just want to have time together. So he's like, let's go take a walk, just you and me by the tracks. I've lived here before. I know exactly where I'm going. And I was like, oh my gosh, alone time with you. Let's do it. Two of his fraternity brothers realize that we're going out to take a walk. And they're like, hey, we'll go with you. And I'm like, oh, geez, my knees. So the four of us go to take a walk by the tracks. I think that the two fraternity brothers that had come down there with us started to realize that Chris and I just really wanted to be alone. And so they were like, we're going to go back to the party. You guys can stay here. Chris and I stayed by the tracks. He had a couple beers in his backpack. So we each grab a beer and we just sit down on the tracks and we talk. We sat and talked there for about 30 minutes. We got up to go back to the party around midnight. We're walking to go back to the party the same way that we came. And as we come to an electrical box, which was pretty close to the road, a man comes out from behind the electrical box.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Big color, bigger savings. It's Sherwin-Williams' biggest super sale. Get 40% off paints and stains October 17th through the 27th with prices starting at $29.39. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
A man comes out from behind the electrical box. He says, do you have any money? Chris is like, we don't even have a dollar. We'd give it to you if we did. He starts going through Chris's backpack. But what he was really doing was that he had a weapon on Chris and he was tying up Chris's hands behind his back with his backpack. I couldn't see this really happening. It just seemed so surreal at the time. I start to think like, okay, do you want our credit cards? Do you want our ATM cards? If you want money, I can go to the ATM and get you money. He's just saying no to all of our offers. And I'm like, I don't understand this. What does he want? He ends up coming over to me. And that's when I see that he has this weapon. It looked like an ice pick. It was thin and sharp. He takes off my belt and he ties up my hands behind my back with my belt. From the moment he tied my hands, I was trying to get them untied. At this point, he drags Chris over into the weeds to the side of the tracks. I see that this is painful. So I just walk down there where Chris is. My thought was, I'm not going to leave Chris here. I have to make sure Chris is okay. He has Chris lay on his stomach. He has me lay beside Chris on my stomach. We're probably 4 feet apart. He's saying all kinds of crazy things. He's saying he just broke out of jail. His friend is there too, and he's going to get him some food. He tells us that he has a gun. He just kept going back up to the tracks to this bag that he had. I was constantly turning my head and trying to watch him. He kept getting angry at that. He kept saying, don't look at me. That didn't stop me. I just kept trying to watch him. I remember him going to the bag and he took out some sort of shirt, and I remember him ripping it. He ties up my legs with it and he makes gags for us. When he gagged us, I actually stuck my tongue out because I didn't want the gag to work. I wanted to be able to talk. I thought, as long as I have my voice, I have a lot. I don't know what made me think to do that, but I did it. The gag just falls off then. I had gotten my hands untied at that point, but I'm holding onto my belt behind my back, so it looks like I'm still tied up. Anytime he would leave and go back up to that bag, I was trying to get Chris's hands untied. I was trying to get my feet untied. Chris just kept saying, if you can get your feet untied, run away. Don't worry about me. And I was frantically trying to do all these things and trying to strategize. And I started to get panicky because nothing I'm doing is working. And Chris had this calm over him the entire time. He says to me, everything's going to be okay. And it just calmed me down. I don't know how much time passed before our attacker came over carrying something really heavy. I didn't know what it was, but I knew he was having a hard time carrying it. He comes over to Chris and drops it on Chris's head. I just remember thinking, this is not happening. How can somebody do this? He comes over to me and he climbs on top of me. I realize Chris is making this gurgling sound. So I was like, hey, could you go turn his head to the side so that he doesn't choke? He gets off of me and he goes and does it. Then comes back over to me and he's like, he's gone. Don't worry about him anymore. At this point, I'm like, I'm going to fight him off me. So he climbs on top of me and my legs are still tied, but I'm trying to knee him. I'm trying to bite him. I'm trying to punch him. I'm screaming. And he stabs me in my neck. He sticks that sharp weapon right at my neck. And he said, look how easily I could kill you. It went in, but I didn't feel it. I didn't feel that it was a dire situation for me. So I just stopped fighting. That's when he unties my feet and then takes off my pants and he rapes me. I did not feel anything. I didn't feel the stabbing in my neck. I was not feeling the rape actually happening. I was floating above my body. I was just looking down on it. I start to say, I have a sister and a family that really want to see me again. I told him a fake name. I said, do you have a family? What's your name? I was like, if you let me go, I won't tell anybody what you've done and we'll just go on with our days. I asked him to put my pants back on because I thought, if I'm found here dead, I don't want to be found naked. And I just remember how frustrating it was for him because my pants were inside out. He actually took my pants and turned them right side out for me and helped me get them back on. I remember him taking one of my rings and one of my earrings. I had to help him get my earring out because he couldn't figure out how to take it out. I don't remember being hit. He hit me 5 or 6 times in my face, and he hit me with some kind of board. I think I put my hand up to block it because my hand was also swollen. During the attack, I was trying to dig my hands into the ground and make it known that I was there because I was afraid he would take me away and that nobody would know I had been there. Then I'm also thinking, I'm probably going to die. I had actually said my last prayer and thought, I'm ready if I'm going to die. I'm okay with that. I remember thinking while he was attacking me, I'm going to memorize your face. I'm going to know every tattoo you have, every scar you have. If I live through this, I'm going to get you. And then when he left and I was still alive, I just remember thinking, you don't know it, but I'm still alive. You're going to get it. You're going to get the ultimate justice. I think that he completely thought he had killed me. I don't know how much time passed. I don't know how long I laid there. I remember waking up, but not having any inclination that he was anywhere near me. I was like, I know he's not here, and I'm just going to go get some help. I get up and walk to a house about 100 yards away. I remember choosing the house because the light was on and the television was on. The screen door was closed, but the front door was open. It's like 2:30 in the morning. I'm all bloody. I have this gag tied around my neck. I'm a mess. And I'm walking into this person's house. I did not ring a doorbell. I didn't knock on a door. I just walked in. I'm sure I startled him. I'm like, call 911 for me. My friend's still out there. He hurt us. I'm not even really able to talk because something was off with my mouth. I couldn't quite talk correctly. He ends up calling 911 for me. I don't remember the ambulance and the police coming. I just remember being loaded onto the ambulance. I don't really remember the chaos of sirens and a bunch of people. I kept telling the guy that was in the back of the ambulance with me, I was like, my friend's still out there. Make sure they know my friend's still out there. At that point, he knew that Chris died at the scene, but he didn't tell me that. And so we're riding to the hospital and I ask him if we can stop at McDonald's and get me a cheeseburger on the way because I was starving. I'm trying to make a joke even in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. I keep in touch with a lot of people from that night, and the EMT driver is one of them. And he said that he really didn't want to leave me at the hospital because he knew I'd be alone at the hospital. After I think something this traumatic and losing control, you don't want to be alone. They take me into the ER and they assess the damage. I had a broken jaw, a broken eye socket, and numerous cuts in the back of my head that had to be stapled shut. I remember begging them not to shave my head because that just would have been the worst thing ever. There's nothing they can do for the broken eye socket. It just had to heal on their own. And then they were scheduling surgery for my mouth to be wired shut to fix my jaw. I got taken to a room. My parents arrived on the way to the room. The first thing I said to my dad was, Chris died, didn't he? Because nobody was talking about Chris. Nobody was confirming whether he was alive or dead. And he said, yes, Chris died. I was taken to a room and really began the process of healing. And I'm thinking, I have two choices. I can either crawl in a hole and not come out again, because that would be okay. But also, I could just do something. And so I was like, okay, well, I'm going to choose to do something. I don't know what that's going to be. It might just be that I figure out a reason to smile every day. It might just be that I get up every day and decide to keep breathing. So I remember thinking that in the hospital, that I want to do something. I'd immediately deal with physically healing. I felt so supported and so loved. I felt like people were praying for me that I didn't even know. And I really felt that power of prayer and that power of positive vibes. I gave my deposition 3 days after the attack. For 5 days, I'm in the hospital. For a month, I go home and I'm healing physically. And then I had to deal with Chris dying and kind of myself almost dying at the same time. And then I had to deal with being raped. That was because my mind only let me deal with things as I could. In the very beginning, everybody was saying to me, Holly, you really need to go to therapy. And I'm 20 years old, turned 21 that year. I'm like, I don't need therapy, but I'll go to it because everybody thinks I should go. So I go to therapy. And of course, at the University of Kentucky, you're going to students becoming therapists. So poor thing, I went to her. I pour out my story to her. And I think she started looking through her book going, oh my gosh, I don't know what to do. So it didn't go well. Therapy, it is part of my life now. When you do need it and can actually gain from it, that is something that I use tremendously. I need it in my life now. Really, a big part of my healing was hanging out with all of Chris's friends and reliving Chris. I didn't really get to know him for that long. I befriended his friends. We all healed together. We would get together every Sunday and cook dinner. We all hung out all the time. And it was this amazing group of friends that we were carrying each other through it. So it was not just me helping them, but they were helping me too. I didn't deal with being raped until almost 1 year after the attack. I had so much to deal with physically and then dealing with Chris dying, so much to grieve. I joined a support group. And for me, a support group was a huge help because hearing other people's stories and knowing that what I was going through wasn't crazy was super helpful. There was somebody else in that support group that had been raped by a stranger who had broken into our apartment. We connected. It was just an amazing feeling to have this person that is having the same feelings as you. I read every book I could find that was written by a survivor. I wanted to read it. I wanted to know their story. Talking about it was a huge part of my healing. To get that story outside of you is so powerful. You don't have to go and talk to a bunch of people. It could just be that you write it down or you talk to a therapist or you talk to a friend or a family member. It's that getting it outside of you that helps lose its power over you. My speaking has definitely been a journey. I remember the first time I ever spoke, I read every single word I said. I had it all written down and I could barely get through it. And I started to realize that I'm doing these speaking engagements. I'm talking about this horrible day. But what I'm also doing is creating awareness. I was talking to the young women going through recruitment at the University of Kentucky. I'm trying to help them while they're helping me, because me telling my story and getting it outside of me was huge in my healing journey. I tell people all the time that anytime they hear me speak, you're part of my support system. Everybody listening today is part of my support system. It grows every time I tell my story, and that's what's unbelievable. Every time I tell my story, I feel that strength in those other people. I always wanted my day in court. I had thought that's why I survived. My day in court came when my attacker was actually caught almost 2 years later. He surrendered to a Texas Ranger. The trial was actually for Dr. Claudia Benton in Houston, Texas. They flew me into Houston the night before. The thought of testifying, I knew I was going to do it, but it still was super scary. I knew it was going to be really hard, but I really wanted to do it. The night before, I had a panic attack. I woke up during the middle of the night screaming and crying. I don't know if I would have made it had my sister and my parents not been there with me. They held me and let me know everything was going to be okay. I arrived at the courthouse. They took me in an underground secret door. I'm waiting with my family to go testify. Of course, I say I have humor when you shouldn't have humor. And I had Chris's buckles to his Birkenstocks. He had been cremated. And his buckles obviously were left over after he was cremated. His parents had given me those buckles and said, I don't know what you're going to do with them, but just take them to the courthouse with you to give you strength. Know that Chris is with you and do whatever you want with them. So I was like, I need to leave these here. I was trying to figure out where to put them. And we're in this conference room. I'm with my parents and my sister. So I realized that it's a drop ceiling. And I was like, Dad, go lift up the drop ceiling and I'll throw these buckles up into the drop ceiling. My dad gets up on a chair. He lifts the ceiling tile up and I throw the buckles up there. I'm thinking the next time somebody goes to change one of these ceiling tiles, it's going to fall on their face and it's going to be funny. They're not going to know where these came from. My dad is getting down off the chair as the bailiff comes in to get me. And I'm sure the bailiff's like, what the heck was this guy doing on a chair? It's almost like he got caught. At that moment, we're all laughing. It was so nice to be laughing as a family and think this is so funny when you're getting ready to do this horrible thing. I'm taken by the bailiff into the courthouse. I walk through the door that only the jury had walked through. The jury had been sequestered for over 3 months for this trial. The jury didn't even know who I was. The prosecuting attorney asks me my name and what I had done the weekend before. I was really excited to say I had just graduated from college. Felt like that was a big deal because I almost didn't make it to graduate from college. I remember the prosecuting attorney saying, look straight at me, don't look at him. He'll be off to your left. Don't worry about him. And so I didn't. I just looked at her and answered her questions as best I could. I'm crying through it all, but it went okay. Everybody in the courtroom was crying. Even the jury was crying. Except my attacker was not crying. They get to that point in the trial when they say, is the person who attacked you in the courtroom today? And I didn't know this actually happened. I had never been in a courtroom before. This was just something I had seen on TV, but it really did happen. And they said, is he here? And I'm like, well, this is his trial. I know he's here. So I was like, yes. And then they're like, could you please tell us what he's wearing? I'm like, oh man, I'm going to have to look at him. So I gather up the courage and I look at him. He's just got the smirk on his face, black eyes, and I say, he's wearing a white button-down shirt. I start breaking out in a cold sweat. I know that I'm about to faint because I had had that feeling before. And I think everybody in the courtroom realized it too. Quickly, the judge says, prosecution, do you have any more questions? They were like, no. Defense, do you have any questions? And the defense did not question me. They said, no. I was the last witness. Then I was picked up by the bailiff and taken back out of the courthouse. At this point, everybody was trying to get me on camera because there were no TV cameras allowed inside the courthouse. I remember on the way back to the airport, we're driving in this big SUV with tinted windows, and it's an armored vehicle. I roll down the window and we drive by the front of the courthouse, and I wave to all the news people out in front of the courthouse. It just was such a funny moment because I'm thinking, you don't know who I am, and I'm just waving at you. I have to find some reason to laugh. It makes me feel more comfortable and oftentimes makes other people feel more comfortable. But it also can be a defense mechanism. You can use that to numb yourself and not feel things. So I have to be careful with my humor. I didn't find out about the verdict until I was already home. We get home and we turn on the news. We hear that he's given the death penalty and, of course, that there'd be an automatic appeal. I still always had the feeling that he could get out on some kind of technicality. Something could go wrong and he's going to get out. Of course, at this point, I had released my name. I can't have him out in the world again. That can't happen. I knew it would take a long time for him to be put to death. I was glad that I wouldn't have to have my own trial. I didn't think I could get through it. I was glad that I was only during the penalty phase of another trial. He was put to death on June 28th, 2006. I chose not to go to his execution because he represented all these bad feelings. The anger that I felt against him, the revenge feelings that I had that I wanted to hurt him. Things that you don't want to feel on a normal basis. I don't want it in my life and I want to focus on all this good. So what I did is I let that all go with him. That doesn't mean I don't ever feel those things. The day that he was executed, I was actually in Washington, D.C., receiving an award for the greatest community service that's given in Washington, D.C. They gave it to me for helping to start a nonprofit, which at that point it hadn't even started yet. I'm just going, how amazing that all this good is happening. The nonprofit that I've helped to co-found is called Holly's House. It is in Evansville, Indiana, in my hometown. It is an advocacy center for victims of intimate crimes that provides support, promotes justice, and prevents violence. We provide that safe interview location. We do a one interview process for victims of intimate crimes so that they only have to tell their story once to a trusted individual. We have all the resources available for starting your healing journey after you decide to report that crime that has happened to you. It might be that you need therapy. Holly's House has been open since 2008. Now today, Holly's House has helped over 4,000 victims and is going strong. Really, what's amazing is we've taught hundreds of thousands of children a program called Think First, Stay Safe, because we want to prevent the violence from happening. And a big part of violence is child abuse and child neglect. And it is a program that teaches the children the lures that predators use to try to make them victims. That program is taught to pre-K through sixth grade at their appropriate developmental level. Noemi Dominguez, who my attacker killed, her brother has established scholarships in her name and even opened a school, I think, in her name because she was a teacher. And how amazing is that? People are doing such good things in the name of these people that lives were cut short by this attacker that hurt us all. The story is so much bigger than just me and Chris. It's so many more people and so much more. I want to let the world know what Chris was like. There is nobody else like him and probably never will be. He was truly the most unique, charming, wonderful person that isn't in the world anymore. And that's what's sad. I think it's more effective to really look at the stories of the people and the lives that were affected by this person. I don't even mention my attacker's name because he's not worth it. I try not to because he is not the story. I am. Chris is, and all of his victims. There were 15 people that he killed that we know of. There's probably more that we don't know about. All of those 15 people that he killed, all of those people have loved ones, people that loved them, and people that are continuing on doing amazing things in the memory of their loved ones. And that's what I love to hear and love to see. We are resilient people, and we can get through anything. It's not until we need to find the strength that we even know we have the strength. Your life is not defined by something that happened or one story. We are so much more and can focus on so much more. We are all in this together. I don't mind that people are really interested in true crime right now, because it is going to create a more aware community and can make more knowledgeable people. And I don't think that that's a bad thing. At one time, I felt a lot of survivor's guilt. I felt overwhelmed. It's too much. I can't be the only known survivor. That can't be my title. But what I realized is that hopefully, if I can be any kind of beacon of hope and of inspiration, then that's what I want to do. And that's what I want to focus on. So my book is called Soul Survivor. It is the inspiring true story of coming face to face with the infamous railroad killer. It is available on Amazon. It was really hard to write the book. I wrote it at the 20-year anniversary of the attack, and I don't think that I could have written it before then. It's a hard book to read because, yes, it is the story of what happened, but mostly it's my survivor story, and it's the healing journey story that is unique. I think everybody's healing journeys are unique, but mine was a bit unconventional. If people can read my book and see my unconventional approach to healing and know that there's really no wrong way to go about it as long as it's healthy. So that's what my book might teach someone. It also just is inspirational. I don't think I'm on every social media site, but on the main ones, I'm Holly K. Dunn. If you just search for Holly, the letter K, D-U-N-N, then you will probably find me. I love when people connect with me on social media. So if anybody wants to send me questions or send me a message, I love to read things that come from my supporters. So please feel free to reach out.
Thank you so much for your time, your energy, everything you've done in all spaces, criminal justice, media, survivor, nonprofit. I am so grateful that you would give so much energy to our audience today. Thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for all the work you're doing. I'm thankful for you out in this arena too.
This episode is dedicated in loving memory of Chris Mayer, Michael White, Wendy Von Huben, Jesse Howell, Leafy Mason, Fanny Whitner Byers, Claudia Benton, Norman Skip Cernick, Karen Cernick, Josephine Convica, Noemi Dominguez, George Morber, Carolyn Frederick, and the other victims who still remain nameless.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
I was already a therapist. I was working in the Bronx. I was only in that relationship for a year and 8 months. The cycle of abuse was rapid, so the ups and downs of the roller coaster ride were particularly close together. He bleached my clothing, spit on me, went after my license, continues to be problematic. A lot of that came out in the press, and that's why I can speak to it.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.